Was it necessary to try and diversify the economy of Las Vegas, given that, I mean, gaming and tourism bring in money, but if people don't have money to spend, that can drop off?
Well, I think I became a believer in diversification basically after 9/11. Because the day after 9/11, for whatever reason, whether it was the casinos wanted to hit a bottom line that they could live with, or they wanted to lay off people, or the economy justified it, whatever reason, it showed me that the be-all and end-all cannot be one industry. And it's treated us very well. Gaming has really given us a quality of life second to none, basically on their back. But that's another time, another day. I think we really have to branch out and have new businesses here, new ways that income is generated. Now, that's why I love this idea of medical tourism, because it will bring smart people into our community. They will insist in making sure there's no mediocrity here. They will get behind the community projects like a world-class performing arts center, like world-class medicine. I think that's where our future is going to be.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. The Detroit Symphony Orchestra has been on strike for more than a month now. The symphony faces stark financial challenges, and musicians and management remain far apart. After new talks last weekend, concerts were canceled for another 3 weeks. Michigan Radio's Jennifer Guerra has our story.
The Detroit Symphony Orchestra is one of the top 10 orchestras in the country, but it's a top 10 orchestra with a $9 million budget deficit. So to stay afloat, cuts need to be made. At least that much the two sides agree on. The musicians proposed a temporary 22% pay cut. Management wants to cut current players' salaries by a third, new players' salaries by 42%, eliminate tenure, reduce the size of the orchestra, and require the players to teach and perform outside of the regularly scheduled concert season.
It's probably the most extreme attack which has ever been made on a major orchestra in the United States.
Hayden McKay has been a cellist with the DSO for 27 years. He says the cuts management proposed would irreparably harm the quality of the orchestra.
It seems that our management is trying to make an example of the Detroit Symphony as to how an American orchestra in a time of crisis, which may or may not be just a convenient reason, can be completely reshaped.
And he says orchestras around the country are watching to see what happens. DSO president Ann Parsons wouldn't comment for the story, but board member Gloria Heppner says she doesn't think management's proposal is really viable.
Not if one wants to retain a top-tier orchestra, it isn't. We could always have a community orchestra, but that, believe me, is not what this is about. We're fighting for the maintenance of a first-class orchestra.
If the fight goes on for much longer, it isn't good news for management or the musicians, since it presents an economic hardship for both. But Mark Clegg, a music historian at the University of Michigan, says both sides feel that the stakes are large.
Part of the reason why both sides are so inflexible is that each sees their response as being symbolic and having a domino effect all the way across the industry.
Now, it's not like the DSO got to this point overnight. The orchestra is just one of many Detroit organizations that have been hit hard by the recession. And Clegg says it didn't help that management decided to cut its development team way down to save money a couple years ago. That meant less fundraising staff. Then there's General Motors and Chrysler. They used to sponsor series and education programs, but can't afford to do so anymore.
The other critical part of the DSO situation right now is the extension onto Orchestra Hall.
The DSO used the interest on its endowment to pay the mortgage on a $60 million building expansion. But the endowment took a huge hit in the recession, so now the DSO has to cut into the principal of the endowment to pay off the mortgage. So the solution?
I don't know. I mean, I know the musicians hope that, you know, I think everybody hopes that some sort of angel donor would come in and fix this basically budget imbalance.
It's not unheard of. An angel donor swept in and donated $85 million to save the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra last year. Short of that, the two sides of the DSO have a wide gap to bridge. For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Guerra in Ann Arbor.
In Kilkenny, Ireland this weekend, the practitioners of two very different disciplines are sitting down together. Their goal, first and foremost, is to make sense of the world economy. If that fails, make fun of it.
What we've done is we've taken together Ireland's finest stand-up comedians and some of the world's finest economists, and we've come together for the first of its kind, which is an economics festival where the comedians ask the questions of the economists.
That's David McWilliams. He's an economist, not a comedian, and he's the man behind the first ever Kilkenomics Economics and Comedy Festival. Those questions he mentioned will be asked in Q&A sessions all over Kilkenny, in bars, restaurants, and theaters. McWilliams hopes to cut through the language and pretense that make economics often seem impenetrable.
If the average guy comes in and he sees a stand-up comedian asking the question of these serious economists, well, then ultimately people in the audience will say, yeah, I'm going to ask that question. I now have permission to do so.
The point, he says, is actually pretty serious.
If you think that knowledge is power, well, then giving people the knowledge, packaging the knowledge in such a way that the knowledge becomes accessible, then empowers the people. And a powerful people, an educated people, is the type of people that don't make the same mistakes twice.
Now, in addition to sparking probing questions from the public, the festival should also get attendees laughing. Even economist McWilliams finds humor in the near collapse of the world economy.
The funniest thing is the fact that the banks who destroyed it are largely untouched.
The Kilkenomics Economics and Comedy Festival began yesterday in Kilkenny, Ireland, and continues through the weekend. One final note, festival organizers have created their own currency. They're calling it the marble. It's worth 10 cents more than the euro and will be accepted temporarily throughout Kilkenny. In fact, David McWilliams points out, for one weekend, the marble will be the strongest currency in Europe. You're listening to All Things Considered.
As we just heard, the Federal Reserve's controversial action was intended to stimulate the U.S. economy and job growth. The numbers for job seekers these days are dire. Nearly 15 million Americans out of work, another 9 million underemployed, and the jobless rate seemingly stuck at 9.6%. But there's another statistic that gets less play. The number of people considered long-term unemployed is at levels not seen since the Great Depression. These are people who've been out of work for 6 months or more. Today in our series on human capital, NPR's John Itzde examines what happens when workers and the skills they have are sidelined for so long.
Being out of work for more than 6 months isn't for the faint of heart. Just ask Sheila Egan. She's been out of work for more than a year.
I really think that if people aren't going through this right now, they don't get it. I don't think they see how difficult it really is.
Egan, a 47-year-old single mother, sold pharmaceuticals for a big European firm for 11 years. She made a six-figure salary. Prior to that, she had applied for only 5 jobs in her career.
And of those 5 jobs, I got 4 of them. And it has been very jarring to apply for a job that asks for 1 or 2 years' experience. You have 10, and you don't even get a call.
Of course, Egan is not alone. Over 40% of the unemployed, more than 6 million Americans, have been out of work for 6 months or longer, according to government statistics. Those numbers came alive for Sheila Egan at an outplacement center she used to visit regularly.
Every Wednesday morning, this room would fill with these incredibly talented, motivated, optimistic people. And I would just sit and look around the table and think, I cannot believe these people don't have jobs. And week after week, they would come back and I would just be stunned at the amount of talent sitting in this room unemployed.
The wasted human capital is just tremendous.
Jacob Kierkegaard has studied the effects of long-term unemployment in Europe, where it became a huge problem, with more than half of all jobless workers experiencing long-term unemployment.
Once people become unemployed for long periods of time, you start seeing a serious depreciation or a reduction in their skill levels, in the human capital that they carry.
That happens in several ways, says Kierkegaard, a fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. One is when people are forced to look for jobs outside their current occupation.
If you shift from being an auto worker to being, you know, a nurse, you basically lose all the human capital that you embodied as a skilled auto worker.
Now, if that unemployed auto worker became a skilled nurse, that could be a good thing. But in the current situation, when large numbers of people are being forced to trade down from high-skill jobs, the sidelining of their old skills is a big drag on the economy. And even if people stay in their current occupation, skills can atrophy after a worker is unemployed for long periods, says Kierkegaard.
They essentially lose contact with the latest developments in their own field.
Sheila Egan worries she's falling behind on news about medical developments, which could hurt her chances of being rehired as a pharmaceutical sales rep.
Especially when you're looking at medical and scientific journals, they oftentimes require a subscription or a pretty hefty annual fee.
Expenses she can't afford right now. Egan is resigned to the prospect that even if she does land another job selling pharmaceuticals, it'll be at lower pay. Of course, says Jacob Kierkegaard, it's not just individuals that suffer when valuable human capital is lost or sidelined.
It is a tremendous drag on overall economic growth. There's no doubt about that.
Europe demonstrated that in the 1980s and 90s when high levels of long-term unemployment meant it grew slower than the United States. Kierkegaard warns that the level of long-term unemployment in the United States is unlikely to fall back to pre-crisis levels anytime soon, so the U.S. must do more to keep skill levels high for those workers. That means spending much more on effective retraining, he says.
If there's one thing where it is sensible for the government to have a bigger deficit in the short term in order to avoid long-term lower economic growth, it is in combating long-term unemployment.
Kierkegaard says the federal government has had the right idea, putting more money into community colleges recently. But that's been offset by cuts at the state and local level during this deep downturn. Now, with controlling deficits on the front burner politically, finding money for retraining to protect the nation's human capital will be a challenge. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.